Well, hi, this is Dave. Welcome, everybody. I'm excited about doing this with you, and I really appreciate those of you who have sent in responses to the couple of questions that I ask. I know I got a very recent notification of a number of more registrants. You just received your email with these two questions. So if there's any response you'd like right now, like to do, the questions are, what's the most important question you want to have addressed during this series? And for your optimum benefit, what would be your best takeaway 4 weeks from now? We're going to be talking about stress mastery and peak performance, look at the latest research and application on optimum performance under pressure, and look at some mentor coaching strategies to understand that you can, how you can use them for yourself and your clients, whether it's business, the arts, sports, and we're going to cover a range of proven mastery tools and peak performance strategies. So there's a lot of information I want to share with you. I hope you've seen the outline and the resource guide on the landing page where you saw the ports where the recordings are going to be. I'd suggest that you print that out. You can follow the outline and don't have to take any notes, ideally. And there are resources and exercises in the second document to download and print. I'm going to refer to a couple of those periodically to highlight them, but they're also there for your interest. And as I mentioned in the announcement, this is being recorded for online playback, and that page that you received will be where they are. So anybody want to add or ask anything or just check in? Any responses to either of those two questions before we begin? I'll reserve time at the beginning and at the end each seminar so that we can have a discussion. So anything any of you want to add or ask? I can say positively that you're managing the background noise very well. Thank you for doing the star six. Remember, when you want to talk, unmute and do star six. Anything, any responses right now to either of those questions? What you most want to get from this series? What you want to walk away with? And remember, or recognize, those are the two questions that you probably ask each of your coaching clients as you begin with them. What do you want to focus on? What do you want to walk away with? So your responses, and thank you again for those of you who have responded by email and will, he said nudgingly, it helps me get an idea of what to integrate into the discussion to be sure that we will cover that. And my first response is to Jen, who wanted to integrate neuroscience. That's what these 4 hours are going to be about. So strap your seatbelt. We're going to be doing that. Any other responses or questions or additions right now? Okay, I will put us on lecture mode, and we'll have a bit more time at the end. So hold on. Okay, we're going to talk in this first seminar about some stress mastery strategies and tools. Again, the essence of this is in your outline, and I just want to tell you some stories, bring it alive, integrate some studies that will be practical and usable for you as coaches, hopefully. When I was in the singles ski lift line at Steamboat Springs, about to advance to the chairlift, an instructor behind me had 5 little kids, all about age 5 or 6, and asked me if I would mind if 2 of them rode the chairlift with me. Well, of course, I welcomed the opportunity. As we got on the lift, the little girl next to me had a kind of an awkward seating and seemed to slump a little bit as we were riding and talking. As we got closer to the end of the lift to ski out of the chair, she said in a really timid tone, "I'm scared to get off." And I said, "I understand." And then I ask her, do you know who Laurie Hernandez is? It was just after the 16 Summer Olympics when Laurie had won a gold in the team event and silver on the balance team beam. The little girl looked at me and said, yeah. I asked her if she would like to know what Laurie did when she was scared about performing her gymnastics routine. She immediately said yes. I told her that Laurie did three things. She pictured herself doing a perfect routine, a vision of exactly how she would perform. Then the instant before she began, she took a deep breath to breathe in relaxation, breathe out any tension, and said to herself, I got this. Well, my new little buddy seemed interested in this and sat just a little bit more upright. As we were just a few seconds from getting off the lift, I asked her what she would say to herself as she got off. She said in a kind of a timid, hesitant voice, I got this. And I nudged her. I said, say it like you really mean it. Then, in a voice that seemed to channel all her 5 years into someone I would not want to meet in a dark alley, she said very confidently, I got this. As she skied out of the chair perfectly, she stopped, turned around to look at me from about 10 feet away. At the same instant, we both did a one-inch air fist bump. We both smiled, and then she skied off with her instructor. We'll talk about that mantra that my little buddy used in just a bit and look at that systematically. So here's a brief overview. In the last few years, we've seen revolutionary changes in our knowledge of the mind and brain sciences, neuroscience, psychology, performance sciences, to apply new tools to engineer optimum performance. I want to synthesize and integrate these new frontiers to help you consistently attain peak performance mentally and physically and be able to guide your clients in doing that as well. Neuroscientists estimate that 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. This means that the vast majority of our responses are based on established algorithms for behavior, emotion, attachment patterns that aren't consciously processed. This operating system ghostwrites beliefs, emotions, patterns of behavior and attachment, the shadow story, the system that operates on unconscious autopilot. Now, a script refers to the default mode of expectations, experiences, and responses of how we write our stories. Our expectations inform attachment and behavior patterns that result in a typical, even stereotypical, response to certain situations. As we repeat patterns, our brain wires those as the default mode. The script for each scenario in our lives operates largely without conscious thought. Think about, for example, at a family gathering or a board meeting. You tend to sit in the same seat each time. You go to the restaurant, you look over the menu, but order the same thing. To deconstruct this system, to understand the algorithms of patterns of attachment relationships and performance behaviors, we have to examine this default mode, the script. Change involves breaking the script. And you'll hear this repeatedly. If you want to change, focus on the system, not just the goal. You know, it's easy to change someone's mind or for you to change your mind. The hard thing is changing your brain. We can engage in self-directed neuroplasticity. In other words, to create new behavior and new brain changes side by side with unlearning old automatic behavior. We're going to come back to each of these, how unlearning is a part of this too. The approaches to changing behavior that work will also consider what this does to your personal stories, your identity. So, how many of you know how to program a computer? Algorithms, pattern sequences? Not me, and I know where I'm putting my money for you guys. An algorithm is a finite series of steps used to solve a problem or make a decision. I'm going to teach you how to reprogram your mind software and rewire your brain. There are two proven systems, both included in the outline, to apply to stress mastery and optimum performance. The microsystem, the neural conditioning chart, and we'll go over all this, is a systematic way to identify stressful emotional triggers and to rewire planned ideal responses for optimum behavior or peak performance. The roadmap system is a macro system of how we understand our stories, a strategic way to deconstruct and understand our personal stories, our personal performance, and to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior to perform under pressure. Now, here's a word on the limits of algorithms. This is from Harris County, where I live in Houston, Judge Emmett Smith. He said, for Houston, Texas, 3 500-year floods in 3 years means we're either free and clear for the next 1,500 years or something has seriously changed how we understand this. So there are limits to algorithms. Science is about patterns, the fundamental laws and principles that form the foundation of our lives and world. The brain is a pattern-seeking organ. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to the way the mind and brain work. That's what we're going to address, how to facilitate or catalyze change consistent with how the mind and brain work, way more powerful and way more effective. It's not about having the answers, since most of our operating system is unconscious and not directly accessible anyhow, but about having the informed framework to ask the right questions and an evidence-based system to implement strategic change for best results. In other words, to create an optimum performance story. I'm going to refer you, because I don't want to take the time, and I think you'll see it in a very succinct way, to the, I think it's the last blog of mine on MentorPath, and there's a top tab for blog. It's called How Do You Help Someone Change Their Mind? When Dr. Helen Czerski was studying physics at Cambridge, she was in her grandmother's kitchen looking at textbooks and charts of quantum mechanics. Her grandmother looked at her material and said, "What can you do when you know that?" Dr. Czerski has spent an expert lifetime answering her Nana's question. And the unspoken follow-up question that she knew her Nana thought but didn't say as she waited for the answer, "And why should I care?" We're about to answer Nana's two questions, spoken and unspoken. First, we're going to look at several minds, two brains, one focus. That's exactly what we do in coaching, by the way. Several minds. A state of mind is like a software program that determines what we perceive, how we process information, as well as how we respond. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, what to do. Each mindset, each state of mind is its own software program, complete and internally consistent. A mindset frames the process of our operating system. It includes how we perceive something, what we do once it's input. It includes powerful beliefs that inform the stories we write about ourselves. Researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the physical world. What this means is the human brain operates like a Google map. We see or perceive something, boom, we boot up a particular mindset, a map to deal with it. We see something else, we boot up the mindset to deal with that. What this means is that we need our own story to make sense of these aspects, these storylines, to make them consistent and cohesive. So when a new situation arises, a different map's booted up. We have different states of mind for different situations. So it emphasizes how important the context and framing is for different situations for us to have a cohesive story to organize and direct that series of maps. Now, what does that better than anything? I would say it's our own internal compass of needs and ideals. Those form the foundation of the sense of self. But we'll come back to that too. Now, state always comes first. The state of mind, then it's strategy and story. Those of you who have trained with me have heard me say that more than a few times, because the first thing that we can do effectively may be to resonate with someone's experience if they have a little bit of difficulty regulating that themselves or seem really upset. Just to resonate with their experience creates a common ground, a foundation that we can proceed, then to move to strategy and story. Since a state of mind boots up a particular software program with predetermined meanings, connections, internal associations, a state of mind, just like any software program, the patterns are predictable and consistent. When Susan gets angry with someone on the executive team, she'll become more authoritative and demand better performance. When Robert's confronted with a challenging task, he'll engage an attachment pattern to get someone to make a decision that he'll sign off on. These patterns are consistent because they're hardwired, and they may be the shadow story, that 90 to 95% that someone's not aware of. This systematic approach to breaking the script, which is what we officially do as coaches, directly addresses the default mode of the algorithms played out in relationships, behaviors, emotions. To revise the story, we first have to understand the script. And I'm going to encourage you to do this work and to do the exercises and the reflection first on yourselves before you begin to then apply it to clients. I think it will make most sense if you look at and reflect on this yourself. Then to assess what to do differently and create a systematic way of change. The initial state of perturbation of the default mode is by definition uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to change. It breaks a script, the automatic responses that we hope. If someone were always to respond exactly as we scripted, we never would have any of this dissonance. It also means that if people would respond exactly as your clients script them to respond, you wouldn't have any clients. We'd all be out of business. So the default mode, the script, has its own continuity, and we feel comfortable when things are certain. We're uncomfortable with change when we activate new processes that are different and disrupt the default mode. That's how we learn. We don't learn when we follow the script and it works. A stimulus, such as a memory, a thought, a person, a place, can instantly shift our attention. Once we focus on the stimulus, it boots up a state of mind that then determines how we perceive and process everything that follows. You hit one key on the computer, boom, you have Microsoft Word. That's a whole system. Everything is internally consistent. You operate within it. You hit another access, you have QuickBooks, an entirely different software program. Two crucial elements in performance become how to boot up an optimum mindset and how to develop fully the skills within that mindset for the very best results. To enhance capacity and performance requires two things: deliberate practice and systematic execution for peak performance. We're going to look at both of these in detail in Seminar 3. The brain rewires by focused attention on two things: possibilities and new experiences. The repetition of new experiences then encodes new learning and neural circuitry. That's why we look at possibilities, at challenges, at what's next in coaching, and why we don't necessarily pursue problems, because there's already a pathway in the brain for that, and each time you pursue that, with a client, you get all kinds of reasons, and they're way more comfortable talking about problems, but that etches the pathway even further. And that's why a lot of people get stuck in therapy. So here's an application of the surface and shadow stories. The surface story is our usually logical, conscious intention and aspiration. Remember, that's about 10 to 15%. This is what I want from life. These are my goals. The shadow story that ghostwrites behaviors, that 90 to 95% of our operating system, is automatic and unconscious. And that may include beliefs, stated or not. Well, I don't really think I can do this. The system keeps me from doing what I want. I don't think I was really cut out to have significant money. When the surface and shadow stories go in opposite directions, stuckness results. The surface story and the shadow story express the desire and the obstacle, often simultaneously. The surface story sees money, for example, as security, freedom, pleasure, or worth, depending on the individual. But the same brain is wired to link it to the shadow story of selfishness or greed or evil or I don't think I have what it takes. Two different themes going in very different directions. Two stories stuck because they're opposing each other. A simple example of a surface story. I want to generate more income and create wealth. The shadow story, I don't think I have what it takes. I wasn't born to have money. Or what if I try my best and can't do it? Then I'd really be embarrassed. We want one thing, but may unconsciously do something else. What results reveals which is stronger. We're listening for both shadow and surface stories in our clients. And because by definition, an unconscious operating system is not conscious. But all the evidence is there. All the algorithms that are important to create a story will be there present, here and now, with you, lived out, or expressed in some way in the relationship. You never have to go into the past or into the background. Everything that's important is going to be lived out here and now. A client is always going to show you exactly what it's like to be them. Some of it will be conscious, they'll tell you. Most of it will be lived out in the process. And we'll return to that too. And inhibition is often the expression of a conflict between the surface and the shadow story. Simply an attempt to avoid the dissonance of conflict. Inhibition then becomes the cure for conflict. The biggest obstacle, this is important, the biggest obstacle that keeps us from having what we want is the story we create about why we can't have what we want. I can't find the time. I'm not sure it would be worth it. I may not know what to do. Now, two brains, top-down and bottom-up system. We have essentially two independent brain operating systems with competing interests, trying to balance urges with logical reasons. The most pressing conflict is not between us and the rest of the world, but between our two brain systems. We want to save for the future, yet we enjoy spending money on a purchase now. And our brain even contributes to that, kicks in a little dopamine when we anticipate a purchase. We want to be healthy, and at the same time, we want cheesecake with strawberry topping, or you'll have to fill in your personal. The balance can be tipped by looking at how we write two stories simultaneously that go in opposite direction. It's not a metaphor. It's brain chemistry. One example is the reward center of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, releases the pleasure, chemical dopamine, as I mentioned, with anticipation of a purchase. The pain center of the brain, the insula, responds when we have to part with our money to pay. It creates literally in the brain a pain response. Now, this is why it works for credit card companies to separate the two. You get the pleasure of the purchase now, and tomorrow's another day. You don't have to pay till next month. That's why people spend 23% more on a credit card purchase than they do when they pay cash or buy check. The bottom-up system runs automatically on impressions and feelings. It's immediate and intuitive, and it can't be turned off at will. It makes errors of intuitive and emotional origin that are difficult to prevent And that's where we come in. This is where we earn our money, because inattention blindness, unconscious biases, all the things that a client may not be aware of are what we're listening for and develop a collaborative alliance to be able to deal with. Now, the top-down system is the conscious, logical seat of self-control, executive functioning and reasoning. This determines voluntary attention and choice, the consideration and deliberation of decision-making. Now, when the bottom-up system prevails, decisions shift toward impulsivity, overspending, overborrowing, overeating, other addictive habits, without a conscious regulation or even direction. Now, a particularly challenging problem is the presence of unconscious biases that we've pre-programmed into the bottom-up system without conscious awareness by the top-down system. Things that we may even abhor or want to distance in some way, things that have to do with various kinds of biases that we have toward people or situations, races, economic, gender, any kinds of things that we would consciously detest them, but yet we unconsciously have them there. Awareness of the factors which lower our threshold to resilience against impulsivity becomes essential to recognize. Willpower is a triumph of the top over the bottom system. Willpower means we stay focused on our goals despite the urges of impulses, the passions, along with the default mode of habit. Now, willpower can be influenced by a number of variables that can deplete it: stress, sustained mental effort, even low glucose. Now, to Nana's question, why should you care? It's all crucial for deliberate practice, for skill development, for optimum performance. Now, let's move to one focus. The benefit of a focus, like a map, is all the stuff you don't have to pay attention to. That's why we create a map each session with our client. What do you want to focus on? Where do you want to go? The bookends of the map. Then you move together to do that. A pro tennis player was having an outstanding season in her career. We met just before she left for Wimbledon, where she was one of the top seeds. She was having difficulty with her serve most recently, and her usual powerful, flawless serve was strained. I asked her to take us detailed frame by frame through her usual flow pattern of serve, then to describe what she was experiencing now that was different. When she got to the point of tossing the ball in the air, she had an instantaneous flash of her coach looking at her critically. This nanosecond was enough to cause her to depart from that usual well-developed performance flow that she'd spent tens of thousands of hours developing. This literal nanosecond of moving from the flow state of motor memory of the procedural process became disrupted, and that well-grooved pattern was affected when she instantaneously and almost imperceptibly moved from total reliance on her bottom-up system one, performance flow, her superb performance, to think about what she was doing. Even for that nanosecond, she hit the ball slightly differently. At her level of play, this meant everything. Now, the power is in the focus. The unconscious mind does not distinguish positive versus negative, future versus past, only focuses on the here and now. This is the power of selective attention. The brain works like a camera. Out of all the possibilities, what you choose to focus on determines the awareness and aligns the energy field of your brain for attention. Attention holds the key to choice architecture, our specialty as coaches. Attention serves to regulate emotion and thus the state of mind that's chosen for a task. Successful performance execution depends on directing and sustaining focus to a specific choice and ignoring all others. Here's an application, a kind of a practical, goofy application, but it'll give you the point. My wife gifted both of us with an enrollment in the BMW Racing School in Greenville, South Carolina, for our 10th anniversary a few years ago. It was a fascinating and masterful application of performance science as we went through various aspects of driving challenges with a number of pro racers. One of the early basics they taught us was how to navigate very sharp turns and curves at very high speed. Since our brains follow our eyes, when we look at where we want to go, we create a successful turn even under pressure, they emphasized. If we look at the obstacle we want to avoid, our brain follows our eyes there too, and we get what we focus on. Focus on avoiding the obstacle, you'll regularly hit it. Exquisitely important on sharp turns and high speeds. When a coach focuses on what not to do with players, now read or hear players as clients here because I'll stay with the same metaphor for a little while at least. When a coach focuses on what not to do with players, it becomes a prelude to a choke. Someone getting analytical, especially self-critical, disrupts this performance flow, the bottom-up system, to move outside that zone to become an observer. That doesn't work. Prefrontal cortex doesn't contain the performance flow, and you move from the playing field to the observer's platform, the prefrontal cortex, which is what a why question does or something intellectual, takes you out of the flow entirely. The most fundamental principle is one we know quite well from neuroscience and quantum physics. You get what you focus on, not what you want. So look at where you want to go from the next curve to 20 years from now. Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympian with 22 medals, including 18 golds, described the significance of focus. When I'm focused, there is not one single thing, person, anything that can stand in my way of doing something. When I want something bad enough, I'm going to get there. New neuronal networks and pathways are created when you focus on solutions. It's exactly what we do as coaches, not problems, but challenges and solutions. But, and I want to emphasize this again, the already existing circuitry is further etched when you focus on existing problems, even if you try to solve them. That's why simply seeing problems, like attending a regular meeting of the Ain't It Awful Club, in fact, what's the most common addiction? You should guess this by context. What's the most common addiction that we have as human beings? It's problems. We return to problems because it activates us. We know where we're going. We get all animated. We can talk about the problem. Never mind that it's not going to resolve it, but it activates the brain to look at problems. But to look at a solution focus, way more effective, challenges, because that's new territory. That's not necessarily comfortable. These brain connections literally become mind maps and subsequently influence the reality that we see. We mold our brain pathways and synaptic connections by what we focus on. We choose what we pay attention to. While we can't control what happens to us, we can determine how much it affects us and where we direct and focus our attention. A simple example is that rather than focusing on obstacles that hold us back, since you create the obstacle, it's not there until you create it. It's a noun, not a verb. To refocus on things that move us forward and the positive connections, step by step. Here's a summary in three simple steps to specifically counter negative thoughts or negative self-talk. This was developed by a colleague and a buddy of mine, UCLA neuropsychiatry, self-directed neuroplasticity. There are three steps, three R's. you have a negative self-talk, something limiting, whatever occurs to you, reframe the thought as an error message from your brain. This is what your brain has been trained to do since probably you were very young. And this negative thought is part of what's contained in that time capsule of that particular, say, I can't do it, I'll never recognize it as an error message. Your brain is doing what it's designed to do, to boot up the grooved response. That's the default mode. That's what you usually think about every time you say it or do it or think negatively in that specific way. It grooves it a little bit further. So recognize it very quickly. Error message from your brain. In order to reframe what you're dealing with now, what's the challenge, the opportunity, to refocus on what's the next step. And think about how simple this is. This is self-directed neuroplasticity. This means that you can change your brain, the wiring in your brain, with these three simple steps. And the last one, the focus on the next step, think about how important that is, because how often have you or one of your clients seemed to be resisting something, but the real issue might have been you just didn't know what the next step was. So be sure that when you hang up the phone or leave your video conference from your client, for the next 7 days and 23 hours, they have a plan. They have a system of what to do. In other words, the simple reframing of this whole deal is don't believe everything you think. Now, let's look at how to regulate states of mind and manage emotions. As we've discussed, a state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, behavioral patterns. A key element of mastery is to become aware of various states of mind and to focus on which state works best for what purpose. We all have different states of mind. You know, anxiety, excitement, anger, going to sleep at night. We have many different states of mind. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach, and the meaning determines behavior. So, by changing the state of mind, you change the behavior. Here's what we know now. A gap in performance has more to do with mindset than with motivation, intelligence, and skill combined. When a performer in any endeavor, athlete, surgeon, executive, has practiced essentially the same thousands of hours as the next person, optimum outcome is determined more by specific mental state for that performance. Think about how some things can lower the threshold. This is what you may be wanting to listen for. Your client can lower the threshold to emotional triggers that they otherwise would be resilient to, but that can predispose to compromised performance. Preset meanings, emotional triggers like certain biases, depleted energy, distraction, emotional overwhelm, too many choices that can lead to decision paralysis, significant emotional charge, in other words, specific emotional triggers, after experiencing ineffectiveness or powerlessness. Any one of these can be the same instantaneous trigger to change a state of mind that won't be quite as obvious as the war veteran immediately jumping when hearing a car backfires, because it triggers that whole state of mind that houses all the trauma. Now, one example of an influence about how it can be subtle is how even slightly depleted energy can cause people to fall back to an earlier default mode of thinking and deciding. In one study reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, 8 parole judges, senior parole judges, were studied for 3 years for their decision-making regarding applications granted for parole. The average rate of granting parole by these judges was 35%. The exact time of each decision was studied in relation to the judge's 3 food breaks, morning, lunch, afternoon. After each meal or snack, 65% of requests were granted. just before noon, just before the end of the day, when blood glucose was lowest, their approval rate dropped to almost 0%. These are experienced, seasoned judges. At these times of low blood glucose and greater fatigue, they resorted to more critical and judgmental thinking. I introduced this story as one of a series of strategies to a financial consultant and mentor coaching with me who had an upcoming 3.5-hour meeting with a client who would be potentially investing $30 million with her. Needless to say, one of the things we planned was when to pitch the offer in relation to the snacks. So, as few as 20% of people have a flow experience, a performance flow experience on a daily basis, and 15% of people never really experience it at all. In the zone of flow, of performance flow, we're more likely to perform at our personal best. In this zone, we most readily acquire and integrate new skills in deliberate practice. A typical result of not being in this zone is that attention scatters. Now, the zone experience is one of optimal performance, not only in sports, but in any area of functioning, including executive and parenting. Flow is a very special state of mind, remaining absolutely in the present moment to really stay in that experience of peak performance. Highest performance is within the state of flow to direct and channel skills, creativity, and training in the present moment. Here's an example. One pro athlete who I worked with came to incorporate and apply everything we just talked about in a very simple way in his all-pro career. In football, which is more episodic as opposed to the flow of other, like basketball, for example. So he recognized that after every play, he needed to reset. And for an athlete or anyone really, the most likely times of getting derailed or responding emotionally is after something really good or something really bad happens. And especially when the play didn't come to anywhere near his part of the field on defense as a cornerback, then he knew after each play he would ground himself again, get grounded and centered, and all he needed to do was say one word and he was instantly in that state of peak performance. He would simply say, reset. Any disrupt, if you've noticed the specifics of this, George Kittle does this. He taps the tattoo of Popeye on his forearm after every play. Any disruptive emotion after a big win or a big loss or disappointment can hijack attention and disrupt flow. So we need a way to manage emotions, regulate states of mind. And this can be useful every time right before you accept a call from a client, which is exactly what I do. Any time before you do a presentation or a training, be sure you devote just a moment or an instant to getting totally grounded and centered. So the last thing I want to cover is the microsystem of how to do this, the neural rewiring for emotional triggers. Now, the neural conditioning chart is in the exercises section in the outlines, page 14. And I want to use this to address self-regulation in a systematic way. This is the neural conditioning chart. And I'll tell you how I initially developed it, and it will give an idea of an illustration of how it can work. Barbara began one of our executive mentor coaching sessions to say she wanted to work on a more personal focus as we've been working on her success, career, and functioning, and she was doing excellent in that one. It was an upcoming Thanksgiving holidays, and she kind of said this in an embarrassed way. She said, you know, every time I go home to my family, and it was for one major holiday a year, the particular year we were working, it was going to be Thanksgiving, she notices the same problem. She described the pattern, again, with some embarrassment. we have a big family gathering. My parents, brother, sister, their families all come together for holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave that this time is going to be different. I will not get into arguments or struggles with my parents and brother and sister, and each of these were different, that I will focus intensely on being balanced, not getting upset. And what happens every time, no matter how much I resolve, I can usually last most of the first day. Then something happens and I lose it. I get in a fight with one of my family, which then seems to escalate, then a fight with all of them, and we're at a standoff in a similar way for the rest of the time that I'm there. My first response, remember, state comes before strategy and story, is to reflect how frustrating this must be for her to want an enjoyable holiday with her family, yet be upset that it was not this time for her. And she wholeheartedly agreed. I said, at the time you're in the middle of that upset and in an argument with them, what's the age of your conversation and your experience? She knew immediately what I was talking about. She needed no explanation. She said, early adolescence. I'm 13 or 14 instantly and totally at that time, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. I asked her specifically what she was aware of that triggered her reactions. And to look at the detail with me, not the broad brushstroke, but the detail, she described a particular look from her dad, a word from her mother, a gesture, this is a condensation, a gesture from her brother, a particular way her sister rolled her eyes. Each one would immediately cause her to get angry and create that state change in her reactive mode of the adolescent turmoil. I recommended that she schedule a time to do a brainstorming session with herself, at least 30 minutes, where there were no interruptions, no distraction, so she could reflect on a new plan. To ask each of these three questions of herself. What are the emotional triggers, these specific emotional triggers that she was aware of from each member of the family? And to be aware of this, to reflect on it without getting triggered, to be like an observer. That's column one, to draw three vertical lines to make four columns. That's the question for the first column. The second column, for each emotional trigger, what is your usual response? The feeling, the behavior for each of those triggers. And this was her age 13 time capsule. Everything in that second column originated then, and she instantly accessed that with that state change. It was the cause of everything that was in column two. I suggested that she schedule another brainstorming session with herself on another day, at least one in between, where she could ask herself two different things. What could she develop for a mantra to get centered and present for each emotional trigger? This is column three. Now, a mantra is exactly what my little buddy and I did on the ski lift. A mantra is three parts, a cue to initiate the process. And Barbara used the cue of touching her ring, because this could be something she could do without anybody noticing, but it really initiated. It was a performance cue. A focus phrase to align the energy field of her brain, and she used relaxed and focused. A physiology such as a deep breath for relaxation and breathing out any tension. And then the other question for this brainstorming session was the question for column four. What, for each of those emotional triggers, is your ideal response? Then to write that ideal response for each emotional trigger in column four. Now, the mantra may be the same for all, but when she follows from column one to two, getting grounded and centered, and then to column four, when she does that enough, her brain will rewire. She sent me the initial draft of the four columns, and I emphasized the purpose of the first two columns was to cue her radar to recognize not only the triggers, column one, but the resultant state change, column two. It's not focusing on the negative, but it's to cue her radar to recognize it quickly. Then she can use, once it's recognized, the mantra to get grounded and centered, column three. Look at page 14. And then engage her ideal response, column four. And I emphasize that she may need to call a timeout a few times to get grounded and centered. This is all a new way of dealing with things. And emphasize, she could always excuse herself from a go to the bathroom, go for a walk. She had this is not the NBA. She had an unlimited number of timeouts. In our first session after the Thanksgiving holiday, I was really eager to hear how it went. She immediately began the session by saying it was the best holiday she'd ever had with her family. There were times of challenge. There were even times when she would excuse herself to use that walk or go into the next room to get grounded and centered. But she was immensely pleased with her work, as I was for her. So just to briefly review these four steps. Column one, emotional trigger. To recognize, identify the emotional trigger. You can't change that. It's an external cue. But what you do with it can begin a different trajectory for handling it internally and externally. To recognize the usual response, the altered state that moves you instantly into the time capsule. So then, these decades-old patterns of thoughts and feelings will not have changed in that time capsule. By definition, it's a time capsule of each state of mind when it's formed. It'll always be the same. But here's the key point. It immediately seems like the content, the trigger, the self-talk, the messages, the negative assumptions created this state rather than it be the result of the state change. The emotional trigger, the response to that created the state change. So it's as if the story we tell ourselves about who we really are becomes who we really are, our core identity, our reality. And it's hard at times to distinguish the stories of a situation from the situation itself. Now, for column three, let me elaborate just a little bit more. If you haven't heard me tell this story before, this is one of the origins of this work. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage, lowest in their division nationwide out of 217 teams. During practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. A cue, he suggested, two dribbles. As they dribbled, a very short phrase that focused the energy attention of their brain, he didn't put it to them in that way, but he suggested something like that fit into the flow of what they were going to do, relaxed and smooth, and then a physiology, a one deep breath in to breathe relaxation and breathe out tension. The two most powerful ways we regulate states of mind, focus and physiology. Now, additionally, he simulated game conditions, would abruptly stop a player in practice, ask him to shoot two free throws, because that's a game condition. You don't get to line up and shoot 30 free throws and count your best in a game. You're usually fouled, you're upset, you're tired, you're having a reaction to somebody who fouled you. So you practice under the conditions you perform. So when they made both free throws, they got a break. When they didn't, four laps. In 2 years, the team ranked number one in their division nationwide. So, again, the ideal response in column four, have a pre-planned ideal response, including behavior. You don't need to figure it out on the spot. You need to have that ready to use as a response. The repetition of these four steps going laterally, horizontally across one row will result in neural conditioning, rewiring your brain for that trigger. So the neural conditioning chart brings conscious recognition of an emotional trigger that otherwise instantly creates a state change to an old state of mind with all of those feelings and behaviors and beliefs. So, in a summary, column one and column two, the emotional trigger and usual response are simply to recognize more quickly the emotional trigger and the state change that it immediately induces. like a time capsule, that content will never change. You can't think, reason, feel, figure, or therapize your way out of state of mind. You can recognize it, though, to get grounded and centered as soon as possible, then to move to the ideal state. As you do this repeatedly, you notice two things. First is that you repeat your mantra of the cue, focus, phrase, and physiology. You'll notice that simply the cue alone will be sufficient to induce a deep, grounded, and centered state. For Barbara, it was just touching her ring that came to induce that state of being grounded and centered. So you've done neural conditioning. You've rewired your brain to use an automatic cue to induce a different state. As you move through these four steps to ultimately engage in an ideal response, when you repeat this enough, it rewires your brain. Ultimately, the initial emotional trigger can automatically coupled with that column four for the ideal response, the default optimum behavior. This is the hard work miracle. Your brain has rewired its operating system, but you have to repeat it. You have to keep doing it. And elite performers in business, sports, the arts, professionals know and live the wisdom that the more enjoyable the experience, the better the performance will be. In fact, as you know from coaching, the reason that we do what we decide to do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. And I want to end with the wisdom of my favorite grandmother. You guys have heard me quote her a few times. She said it very simply. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So next seminar, we're gonna have an open mic for discussion and questions. I thought we'd have a little bit more time. But next seminar, we're going to look at the neuroscience of peak performance and look at aspects of confidence, mindfulness, deliberate practice, including unlearning. So what you got? Clarifications, comments, questions? I'm eager to hear how you're finding this, if this is making sense to you. Thoughts or questions or comments from anyone?
Hey, Dave, it's Eric Jack here. How
Thank
are you?
Thank you, Eric. I was getting lonely there for a little bit, especially at the beginning. How are you, my man?
No, I'm still here. I'm doing well, my friend. It's good to hear your voice.
Now, you are familiar with this. This is old hat. I only had to change up a couple of stories because I knew you were attending because you've done the Peak Performance, the NeuroMentor Institute of Peak Performance Training. So at least I hope that a couple of different stories kept your attention. But go ahead. What you got?
No, what I really, I guess it's a question. How long does it take? How much practice does it take for someone to actually reach that state of peak performance?
Is there any
way to measure time?
Would you repeat that question? I want to be sure I get it.
What I wanted to ask is to a client or to a performer. I mean, I know the athletes you were talking about. How long does it take them to actually develop that habit? Is there any way of measuring how long it usually will take before that habit becomes old hat?
That's a really good question, and the question is it varies. For some very simple behaviors that are simply a cause and effect, it takes less time, and that's where you hear adages about 20 days or 25 days or 30 days. And the story just down the road a piece here at NASA, when the space program put astronauts in headgear that reversed images, everything was upside down, so they had, and they were in the headgear 24 hours a day, they had to very carefully move around, plan ahead every move. And what they noticed was at day 25, their brains rewired. Everything was right side up, and they could move comfortably and fluidly. Now, the group, there was some members of the group that were out of the headgear for an entire 24-hour period at day 15. When the headgear was put back on, then it took them 25 days. But now here's the positive aspect of things that are more remember, the microphone is picking up your cough. If you would do a mute, star six. I don't want to catch anything. those behaviors that are more complex, you know, that are more about attachment and behavior and emotional patterns, it takes longer to do that. Now, Barbara had a pretty immediate result, but she was dealing with some complex behavioral and emotional patterns. Now, the good news is that if you mess up once, it doesn't mean you go back to square zero like the astronauts out of the headgear. You can simply, do the three R's. Recognize the error message from the brain, reframe, and refocus. So those three steps are always there and always there to call on when you need them, when you're doing this change. So it can vary. But remember the key element. Every new step, every different thing someone does, you or a client, the initial response is going to be discomfort because our brains expect a certain thing. The error detection mechanism says, this is not what I expected. And your mind software wants to add to this by doing what's predictable because that reads as effectiveness. So the first step is resonating with a client to understand the trepidation or the uncertainty or just the discomfort, to not read it incorrectly. For example, a common read of this, well, my gut's telling me this is not the right thing, or my discomfort is my intuition's telling me this is not the right thing. That's a misread. This is your mind and brain telling you to go back to what you know and what you're hardwired and softwired to do. So this is where coaching comes in, where you can resonate with and even get someone to develop the self-reflection to recognize and incorporate that discomfort as validation that they're moving ahead, a signpost of being in new territory. So, Eric, does that help to answer that question?
Yes, it does. At least,
great.
Thanks
for that. An important,
thank
basic
you.
Question. Go ahead.
No, as I said, it gives me a good place to start, which is what I was looking for.
Great. Okay, super. And just remember, our experiences, our story, are going to be information about how this happens. That's what we have to work on first, and we can develop the best understanding and empathic resonance when we use our experience being totally attuned to a client about what they're experiencing because of mirror neurons, of what they experience is going to be, even by telephone, I would say even, and this is a different time and a different conversation, even better by telephone than when you have the visual distraction of what a client is experiencing. You know, the mirror neurons were discovered as recently as 1996 in Parma, Italy, when a monkey observing another monkey being given a stimulus like a painful shock, the exact place in the observer monkey's brain was stimulated, was activated, and this began a whole study of mirror neurons, which forms the kind of the substrate of our empathic and intuitive capacity to resonate with someone's experience, and ideally without getting lost there and keeping the client as point of reference. Well, we're out of time, actually a couple of minutes over, and I appreciate your tolerance of that. If you have any responses to the two questions, what's your biggest question about this whole area? What would you like to walk away with? Email me, and I promise I'll look at it, incorporate it into the discussion in some way. I'm operating from the same outline you are, which gives me some leverage about talking about what's of interest and application for you, and hopefully to make this an optimum experience for you. Thanks very much. Thanks for your responses, and let me hear from you. We'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very, very much. I appreciate it. Look forward to resuming a week from now. Thanks. See you guys.
Thank
Take
you.
Care of yourselves.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
See you guys.